Despite Madison's image as a progressive Wisconsin city, it has one of the worst records in the country for failing to help black children achieve as well as white children in school, graduate, get out of poverty, find work, and stay out of the criminal justice system. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. A Race to Equity report issued in 2013 by the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families found alarming results in Dane County showing racial injustice. In response to that report, new initiatives were tried with considerable coverage in the media. How did that media coverage itself reflect racial bias, and what was the result? Today I'm joined by two guests to explore racial bias in the media and public talk. Sue Robinson is a UW-Madison professor of journalism and the author of the recent book, Network News, Racial Divides, How Power and Privilege Shape Public Discourse in Progressive Communities. Kellyam Kerr, former president of the Madison Urban League, now is the director of One City Schools and a community activist. Welcome to you both to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Well, let's start with just sort of your own personal stories here, because Sue, in your book, Network News, Racial Divides, you make yourself part of the story, which is something as journalists you're often trained not to do. You're trained to be objective, to not be part of the story, to kind of distance yourself from the material. Can you tell us something about yourself, your own background as a journalist, and what led you to this project that you embarked on for the book?
Sure. When I was a journalist for about 13 years, I was a business journalist, and I was mostly in New England. I'm white. I'm very, very white. And so then once I became a professor, I considered myself a social scientist. And so for both of those professions, you really need to be, quote, objective, or at least to try to be as objective as possible and to be as neutral as possible when you look at the facts and you think about writing and you think about research. When I started this project back in 2010, I figured that this was just going to be another research project. I was interested in understanding how information flows were being reconstituted by digital platforms. And I was also interested in whose voices were heard in that flow and whose voices were absent. So I was interested in power. I quickly came to realize in the course of the research, during some stumbling blocks in my interviewing and also just my own kind of ignorance around racial issues, that I needed to approach this project in a much different way. So not only did I need to understand the education policy that I was writing about with the Madison Charter School that Mr. Kerr had been proposing at that time and then following with the Race to Equity report, but also in network analysis, which is the method behind the book. But I also needed to understand who I was racially in this story, both as a researcher, what I was doing as a reporter for all those years, how I was teaching journalists now. And it became a much more personal journey for me once I realized that my own privilege was getting in the way of the facts.
You write about it being an uncomfortable experience in many ways, and we'll get into that soon. Kellyam, can you tell me about your own story coming back to Madison and kind of how you got going on the whole charter school issue and some of the things that you ended up overlapping with Sue Robinson on?
Yeah, so I came back in March of 2010, and it was after a year-long courtship of the Urban League's board and past board members. The three people that were most instrumental in me coming back was Lamar Billups, who a lot of people in Madison know. He was working at Georgetown University out there where I was in D.C. at the time. And we had Annette Miller, who was the chair of the board, and then Chuck Taylor, who had been the chair of the board and was really the spearhead of building the building on Park Street. And so they felt that I would be the person that could help really move the community forward. They remembered my activism from being a young man, and people were sad. I learned from Lamar when I had left initially to move to Washington.
Because you were a Madisonian.
Yeah, I was a Madisonian. They felt that I could help here, and I was leaving. And so, you know, I had said I'd never come back, only because of how I felt there was a glass ceiling for us here. But I told Lamar that the only job I would ever come back for was the Urban League job. And I was half joking. And then when the job came open, he called me, and I was driving down Kenilworth Avenue in D.C. I'll never forget it because it's a very busy street, and there's nowhere to really pull over. But he's like, pull over. So I pulled over on the bridge, and cars were just whizzing by. It's like, if I had opened my door a couple inches, that door would have been gone. And so I said, Lamar, I said, you know, I'm not parked appropriately. I said, what's up? Because he said it was urgent. And I knew he had some health issues. And so he told me, there's a job for you waiting back in Madison, was his exact words. I said, oh, what job is this? I'm thinking the university. He said, the Urban League. And I was like, what? What? I said, I was just there like a month ago, and I wrote him a check for some bricks for the new building. I said, what happened to that guy? Because I had just met him. He said, oh, well, he just announced, shocked us all, that he's leaving, going to Minnesota. So we talked about it initially. I said, no, no, thank you. Our family sort of cemented out here. And then after thinking about it, my wife talking to her, she wasn't surprised. She just said, as soon as I told her about it, she said, she looked at me and said, if you get the job, we'll go. And I was like, whoa, because I didn't think those words were going to come out of her mouth. And so then took a long time. It was the longest process, but went through it, came back. And had a chip on my shoulder, though. You know, I had a love-hate relationship with Madison. Loved the people that I grew up with here, went to school with, but hated the institutional structures in the city. And just despised it, really. And did not like what happened to all my peers that I saw. It was frequent. Every time I would come back, it just get worse and worse, bad, more bad stories. And these were people that were smarter than me, more athletically gifted than me. And I was good at both, but there were people in that community that were just awesome. And a lot of them just did not reach their potential, not even halfway. And so when I came back, I said, I'm going to break open these doors. And I told the board that. And I don't think they believed me, because one of the top three things I told them that we were going to do, number two on the list, was we're going to eliminate racial inequality in Madison. We're going to break the door open. And we're going to make this one of the top two issues in Madison. And I remember a couple of them looking at me in my interview. They were like, how are you going to do that? And I had pitch books. Because I was used to fundraising and everything, mm-hmm. So I had put this whole process in a pitch book to them, because I had come back two other times in the middle of this interview process to talk to people, and Governor Doyle was one I talked to. I had talked to a bunch of folks, and so I laid out to them, here's how we would do it. But I told them, I said, you guys are going to help me do it. I said, it's got to become a community conversation. So I knew when I pursued the charter school, I knew it would shake Madison up, but I intended to get it. Because I just was thinking about all those young people I grew up with and how, you know, dashed dreams, and people in Madison have such a short-sighted memory. I'm thinking about the 40 years behind me, and they're thinking about right now, you know, and evaluating the situation within the context of now the new teacher struggle with the governor. And I'm thinking, guys, we're always caught up in your agenda, your reactionary movements. And as a result, we always have to wait. And I'm not willing mm-hmm. to wait. So I just kept pushing forward. And our board, fortunately, we had two boards, the Board of the Urban League and the Board of the School, because the school was going to be its own independent entity underneath the Urban League. And we got together as two boards because there was some fear on there about what was going to happen to me, what was going to happen to the organization, because people were threatening to cut funding, things like that. And then we agreed as a group that we need to be strong. So we need to keep going forward. This is when we knew we would lose. And so when we lost on that vote, you know, I made some strong comments. But I think Madison got a little turned upside down. And there were a lot of reasons for that. But, you know, I was glad that you captured in here in the book how transformational that effort was. Now, that I did not know would happen. I just knew he would shake Madison up. I didn't know all this other stuff would happen as a result of it.
And we'll get into some of the background behind mm-hmm. the charter school that you attempted to form. Mm-hmm. And that was partly in response to this Race to Equity report. Is that right?
No, that came after.
The Race to Equity after you had already started.
So Doug Nelson, who was at the Annie Casey Foundation for years, he came in my office, and he's like a celebrity in the school reform, education, whole social reform movement. So I was shocked. Here's Doug Nelson walking in my office at the Urban League, and the first thing out of his mouth said, you know, Clem, I came to help you. He said, because you're going to get killed out here if you don't have somebody else who's white step up and say what you're saying, but to people in a way they can understand it. And so he said he was going to take on this issue, and they were looking for a home for Race to Equity. And I know they ended up at what is now Kids Forward. Wisconsin. But I was so glad he did, because what they did is they illuminated in a very direct way what was happening in Madison in a way that people in the city could understand it.
And it's hard for people to argue with numbers and data and all that. I know, as someone who's a Madisonian myself and knows that we like to pretend we're progressive or something, that it's pretty shocking when you see figures that show that we're not just one of the worst, but the worst in the country in some basic measures of racial equity. Sue, do you want to talk about how Kaleem's charter school project fit into what you were already working on with your study? And also, for those who are not familiar with it, if you can just tell us about this Race to Equity report that kind of knocked people out of their seats when it did come out.
Sure. So it was in 2010 that I was looking for this new project where I wanted to map a total media ecology in a local community. And I wanted to understand how Facebook and Twitter and all that was reshaping.
Let me stop you. You said media ecology. Yeah. So media ecology would be like the whole picture?
The whole landscape of journalism, all of the platforms that are in public domain that allow people to exchange information about community. So not just journalism, but blogs, radio, Channel 3000, all the ethnic and alternative media in town, and Facebook, Twitter, all of that. And Madison is a very media-saturated environment compared to a lot of other communities that we have. So that's what I was trying to capture. That was my original goal. That goal shifted over time. Somebody had mentioned that Madison Prep, the Madison Preparatory Academy that Kaleem was just talking about, was coming down the pipe, and that would be a really great way to look at a single issue and how it played out in all these domains, and also looking at power, because we knew it was going to be sort of there's going to be a lot of talk about race. There was going to be a lot of talk about progressives. And so that's why we chose that topic. What ended up happening was Madison Prep, I call it a communicative flashpoint, and was one of the primary ones that really woke Madison up in the sense of having a public mainstream conversation about race in the K-12 schools. That's not to say that that conversation hadn't been happening in a lot of other venues before that. There had been tons of task force, tons of committees, lots of reports about those achievement disparities, but they hadn't really reached mainstream until the Madison Prep project happened. And then, so that happened, and my book chronicles that, and then also the aftermath of that. So right after that, there was a pretty contentious Board of Education race that involved some racial issues that followed in 2012. And then October 2013, the Race to Equity report landed, and it was debuted at the YWCA Racial Justice Summit. And that report really aggregated all of those stats and data that had been moving around in different parts of Madison for years. But what they did was they put it into this narrative that really conflicted with the city's identity for itself as being particularly progressive around racial issues. That civil rights history that Madison has, the integration of schools, all of that, really set Madison up for thinking of itself as this truly progressive enclave. And what all of these communicative flashpoints, as I call them in the book, so, for example, the Madison Prep proposal, followed by that school election, followed by the Race to Equity report, then followed by the Tony Robinson shooting, there are all of these turning points kind of in Madison that revealed kind of an ugly side to the city.
Can you tell me about the Madison Prep school? I remember reading about it in the news, which is part of the subject here, is that most of us who heard about it got it filtered through different media lenses. But tell us why you wanted to start a separate magnet school or charter school. What was behind that?
So, and I wanted to do a school as far back as when I was 17 years old, my last year of high school. I was in all upper level classes. I had a 1.5 GPA. I joke with my friends. I was 413th out of a class of 435. That was my ranking. But I said, you know, I got my D's in physics and advanced physics and classes like that. I just hated always being the only black kid in all my classes. And so many of my black friends were on the first floor. And the first floor became known as the remedial floor, you know. And their life opportunities took shape in a similar way as their education had unfolded. You know, undereducated and underemployed. And so when I, every time I would come back home after being in the military, it was just one more sad story after another. So when I was 17, I was watching black entertainment television. That was huge for us back then because black people were on TV in a positive light and we owned the station. And I was listening to a show about black independent schools. And there was a woman in Zynga Warfield Coppock who, when I was at Hampton University for 1 year, I actually was able to go up to D.C. to interview her and write a paper about her. She was talking about African rites of passage and had written a book on it and talked about the importance of black education, the history of education among African Americans, and a list of all these black independent schools that she also had founded, one in D.C. So I was so surprised. I was like, oh, man, I wish I could learn more about that. And I ordered the booklet. I saw all this list of black independent schools across the country, and I immediately said I want to start one of those because I wanted to create a different environment for black students to be educated where I felt culturally we would be culturally supported, we would be pushed forward, inspired to do well and challenged, you know, and I just didn't feel like in the Madison public schools that we were getting that.
And were you already familiar at that point with the work of Gloria Ladson Billings, with the Dreamkeeper kind of stuff, where it looked at the fact that black children do better if they have black teachers, if they have curriculum that reflects African-American history?
No. So I was I transferred to Madison from Hampton University after being there a year. Lisa and I, we got pregnant with our first child, and we couldn't get a good enough job in Virginia, so we transferred to Madison. And, you know, I was in education. I was a Broadfield science major second. I was a pre-med first. And I just was in classes again with all white kids. So I was like, I don't want to do this. And so then I was hanging out at the Boys and Girls Club. It was still the South Madison Neighborhood Center at the time. And just tutoring kids, helping out, and said, how are all these kids on the street during the day? You know, they're not going to school, and it's worse than ever. And so I started to look at education as an outlet. So I changed my major. And then I wasn't happy taking those practicum classes. And so I was like, man, black kids are never going to respond to this. So I was going to drop out and go to Milwaukee to study under a professor there in urban education. And they told me I could create my own major at the university to keep me there, because by then I was already making a name for myself as an activist in the community. Mm-hmm. And they sat me down, John Keene at the time. And he told me about this individualized major, and he introduced me to Michael Onek, who's now a retired professor. And then Michael told me, you got to meet Gloria. And I was like, Gloria Ladson Billings, he told me about the book. I said, oh, yeah, I saw the book in Borders. He's like, well, she's a professor here. I said, get out of here. So he introduced me to her. She took me to lunch. First, we met in her office, and we went to get some lunch. And we've stayed in contact. She calls me our son, like she's just another mother. We've been tight ever since. Gloria has been by my side ever since. And she was on the board of Madison Prep.
Well, and her research really supports what you're saying.
Absolutely.
In terms of, if you want to change that achievement gap, you have to make some changes structurally.
That's right.
To how you look at things. We're going to talk about why the Madison Prep School did not succeed when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Kaleem Kerr and Sue Robinson. We are talking about racial bias in the media and public talk. Sue, in your book, you talk about whiteness and sort of a concept of privilege and about your own journey towards recognizing your white privilege and how that was shaping you as a journalist. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, I struggled with this idea because I also consider myself a progressive and I believe myself to be racially aware and woke, so to speak. I read Coates, you know. and then I started to realize that as I was doing more interviews and I was talking to people and having these sort of disconnects with the people that I'm interviewing, particularly black and brown parents of kids in the schools, and that our experiences were so different. And then in my head, I was going through that process that I think all white people do, which is really like, are they exaggerating this? Or, you know, well, maybe their kid wasn't doing what they should be doing. And you start having all of these thoughts, and then you need to start interrogating those thoughts. And so I went through the YWCA racial justice program, which I highly recommend. It was a bunch of different workshops, and there are readings associated with it. And that really started me on my own personal journey. And so I had to step back, and that's partly why this book took 8 years, because I had to take some time to investigate myself and to research myself, to research my family, to understand how I was a reporter, how I approached race myself, and then also how I was teaching these students in terms of questioning structures that I had just always had a real faith in. Right, because I was a progressive.
And what did your family have to do with it once you started looking into that?
Well, I had to start understanding that race was a very personal thing and that I myself had a race. And once I came to that realization, that meant I needed to investigate who I was, what my heritage was. You know, did my family own slaves way back on the farm in Pennsylvania? What kind of work we had done as white people to build the structures that are now around us that perpetuate these discriminatory practices. So that was part of it, right? And then the other part of it was my training as a journalist. You know, I identify as journalist. I think I always will, even though I'm not actually practicing as a journalist anymore. And that training really reifies the structures that we have in place of government, that government officials are an expert, that reports that are produced by government bodies are the end all and be all sort of expert data set.
You mean that as a journalist, you're trained when there's a story, you go to the experts, and the experts are a sort of limited group of people often associated with the institutions of power, and that you don't get out of that then to hear other voices?
Exactly. And we always have, in newsrooms, there's always that push. You need to go out and talk to, we called them RPs, but regular people. And so you always had those sort of quotas where you go out and you talk to, oh, I'm writing a story that involves race. I'll go talk to my two black people that I have in my Rolodex. And that was just how we were trained. That wasn't any sort of thought of, oh, these people can only have this much say. It was really more just this total trust in the institutions that we were writing about and that we were watchdogging. We were watchdogging for people who were scandalizing those institutions, right? Not necessarily the institutions and the structures themselves. And so when I went through this revelation, I started to understand that we needed as journalists and as a professor who teaches journalists to expand what we understand about good sources, about what we mean by objectivity, and how we go about building relationships on our particular specialties and beats.
So back to the issue of the charter school, Kaleem, that you were sort of you passionately wanted to start a new school that would break this cycle of black children not achieving as well.
Yes.
You know, to do something that would take Dane County, Madison, off that terrible list as being one of the worst places in the country. Tell us about that process and kind of your overlap here with Sue's project of looking at media coverage.
Yeah, so when I said I had a love-hate relationship with Madison, it was because we were such a prosperous community, and you could see it among the children that we went to school with. But it was like, why are the rest of us struggling so hard? Why are we not getting the same opportunities? Why, when they announced that, you know, the class trip we're having and we're all excited, but it's to go and skiing in Colorado, it's like, oh, there we go. I'm never going to be able to participate. We don't have that kind of money. And I don't even know anything about skiing, you know, so things like that. So I always felt like we were outsiders. And the media in Madison made us feel like outsiders.
How?
Only time they would focus on black people is when it was Black History Month. Black exceptionalism, like when Kwame Seltzer was going to run for mayor, I was a little boy. And I remember it's the first time I saw a black man in the newspaper, because my grandmother made us read the Ebony magazine, the Jet magazine. She saved all of them. And then we also had to read the newspaper and the Bible. You know, those were the four things. And so they would highlight those black people that were like exceptional, doing exceptional work. Gene Parks runs for city council, you know, so we would see black people only in positive light then. And then when we committed a crime, or and it was always when a white guy did the crime, it was age 22, you know, he stole something. When it was a black man, it was black male, age 22, he stole something. And so it's like they were always like always putting a negative picture about us out there. And then when you read the media, we had to read Ebony. My grandmother, I realized it later, is that she wanted us to have a positive context of who we were as black people, because the media always showed those things. So either I got to be exceptional, I got to be O.J. Simpson running through the airport, you know, or I've got to be a person who's committing a crime. And so the school that we created, you know, the intention behind it is we wanted to create a sense of exceptionalism among all our kids, that but they could find it within who they were. And so we wanted them to feel culturally safe, competent. We wanted to feel academically competent by working on their skills. We had a whole thing we called prep year in that school, where we would float a year alongside the curriculum. So some kids want to go to Harvard and they go to public schools. They go to a finishing program, we call it, where they go to a prep school somewhere out east, or some Lake Forest, Illinois, their school. And then Harvard, they recruit at those schools, and Stanford and those places. So then they would get access to opportunities there. Well, you got to have resources to do that too, or you got to be a great athlete. And so I said, well, why don't we float that concept of a fifth year alongside? So when kids come to our school in sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth grade, if we test them and they're more than a year and a half academically behind, which research shows teachers who are really good can catch a kid up who's a year and a half behind if they have that concentrated support. But most teachers can't do that. They need more time. So I said, we're just going to take 1 year. They're going to do a fifth year, but they're going to just be in prep year. And we're going to focus on their academic deficiencies to help move them forward. So that was very much rooted in you are going to feel good about yourself and your abilities and where you're going. And if you're struggling to read or struggling to keep up, kids like that, they're the behavior kids. They're the kids who don't want to be in school anymore. They're the ones that will cuss you out in the hallway. And Madison, it's like we're always managing these kids' behavior, rather than managing their sense of who they are and their emotional sense of who they are.
Or changing the root causes behind whatever it
is. That's
right. I think originally you had perceived it as a school for boys only. What kinds of problems came up when you're trying to do a school for African-American boys only, where you're kind of a double you could call it segregation, but it's a double sort of limitation on who gets to come. How did you, before you had to present it to the school board or anything else, how did you envision it in terms of getting around objections about leaving out girls or making it race-specific?
So when I was in D.C., one of the things I became good at, I was really good at organizing both politically and like really just creating big policy opportunities and getting it done. And but you start big. And then you have a negotiation point. So you put it all on the table knowing that here's the point that I'll negotiate to. And so that's how we started. We put it out there, black male school, well, school not for black males, for all males. But we really positioned it as though it was, we called it black male fail proof. and that we are going to create a school that when you look at the students who are struggling the most, we're creating a school around those children so that whoever comes here is going to benefit doubly because there's going to be so much support there for them. And that's when it got pitched as the school for black boys. And I was like, well, I don't care. That's all right. But then black women, I started hearing from them, what about black girls? Because in this city, black girls are equally disadvantaged. But we also had an intention to do that, but 2 years later. So we couldn't. We knew we couldn't start a school that would be that intense, you know, at the same time. But the negotiation point was the state pushed us and the ACLU, you got to start the school together. And initially it was you can't do it at all. But because we had such a big agenda, they knew they just wanted to win some ground. So the ground was, all right, we got to do both schools at the same time. So we said, all right, well, we'll not do 60 boys. We'll do 30 boys and 30 girls. And so our goal was, and I told my staff, we're going to cross every T, we're going to dot every I, we're going to jump over every hurdle, and we're going to give a lot of ground up, but this is where we stop. And the goal was to win people over. And so we ultimately lost the battle. But, you know, in some ways, I feel like we're slowly winning the war.
Well, let's talk, Sue, about the media coverage of this process. While this school is being discussed and the different arguments are coming up, what were you seeing as you're working on your project that ended up being this book? What are you seeing in terms of how the media covered this school?
What I didn't see was any of the information you just told me, which is weird, right? Because I would have liked to have seen a lot more coverage of the school itself and what was going to – why people thought it was necessary and a real kind of huge profile on that. We didn't see that. We saw a lot of binary coverage, the he said, she said. We saw a lot of are you for the school or against the school kind of battle that played out in the media. And I want to point out that all of the newsrooms are in jeopardy, right? I mean, they all, even at that time, were losing resources. They were struggling. So they had way fewer people to cover this kind of giant issue than they would have 10 years prior to that. And so it was a combination of resource issues along with structural issues around deadlines and objectivity. And, well, if you want your name in the paper to talk about your kid's experience, we need to name you. And that really hit up against this fear that a lot of black and brown parents had about repercussions
sure.
of their kids in the schools mm-hmm. or themselves in the workplace. And in fact, people who did speak up did experience those repercussions, or at least they perceived that they experienced that. I talked to one parent who actually moved to New York because of this, and I had an interview with her on the phone. And at the mm-hmm. end of the interview, she said, do you think Madison's changed yet? And then she said she wasn't ever going to come back to Madison. And that was just one, you know, failed outcome I talk about in the book. And so what you saw in the coverage was this kind of superficial, very administrative laden coverage. And I talked to all the reporters who wrote the coverage, and they talked about the limitations and the constraints that they felt that they had. And they were all white reporters who were covering this issue. They felt that whiteness very acutely. So they came into this story about race thinking and internalizing the fact that they were white and could they really cover this story from a racial angle. And so what they did was they covered it from an administrative angle, and they covered the meetings, and their deadlines meant that they needed to go find people who were willing to speak. And that meant people who were at the hearings who had already come prepared. And if they felt like if they went out into the neighborhoods, which a few of them did, and they couldn't find anybody who would speak on the record, they found lots of people who would share stories, but not in the way that their structure wanted to allow them to do it. And so what ended up happening was we saw this coverage that wasn't super deep and never questioned the structure of the schools. So on the other hand, we had the union and some administrative people in the Madison School District who would talk about the achievement disparities only in light of poverty. And the minute that you talk about poverty as being the problem, you close down any kind of discussion of reform because poverty is such an intractable problem. and you have this sort of fatigue when you start talking about poverty and this feeling of overwhelmingness. Like, how are we going to be able to fix that? And so they changed their the way that you talk about it, and you talk about instead this charter school. And so, you know, we knew that the charter school was never going to pass at that time, right? Because we had the Walker situation, we had Act 10, the unions were under attack, the progressives were feeling really nervous and territorial. So they were closing the wagons, so to speak. They were circling the wagons. And so my point in the book was more that we could have had a different conversation about it and had it set a different kind of agenda moving forward, that maybe we could have gotten that charter school a little bit earlier than, although you just got your charter school approved, right?
Recently,
yeah. A different version.
A different version.
Of it. But if you think about it, Kaleem, if you look back, what difference did media coverage play? Or what frustrations? I mean, I think any of us who have seen a program of ours or quotes by us in the newspaper can, you know, it's just aggravating because sometimes they get it wrong or they don't give the context or.
Yeah, with sensationalism at its best. Yeah. I remember having a conversation with Matt DeFore, who was an education writer at that time. He was young. And he had asked me for information about our budget. And I said, look, Matt, I said, I don't ever want you guys to feel like I'm not giving you what you asked for. But I just need you to know that whatever I give you, this is draft form. But he had requested it. And since we were going to be a public school, I said, well, look, I'm going to trust that you report this as a draft. And he said, I will. I'll say that. But he didn't. The headline said this school will cost $27,000 or $28,000 per kid. And immediately it fed into we're going to take all this money out of the public schools and put it into this private charter, even though it was a public charter school. And I was mortified. I was like, how could you do this? And he said,
So you trusted something.
And that's... Yeah. And then he blamed it on the editors or whatever. I'm like, but still, now it's another thing that I've got to deal with. And then the other issues we were dealing with was the issue of power within the union. They felt their power was being challenged big time, not just by Walker. The issue made them very sensitive to it, hypersensitive. But one, people don't know about this, but we were asked by John Matthews. It was October. If you go back and read the October 1st
teachers union
newspaper of 2011, he had announced that it was September 30th or October 1st. He had announced that we had struck a deal. And he, John Roach, who was in that meeting, he's another writer in Madison, Madison Magazine. He said, called it the Perkins Accord because we met at Perkins on the Beltline. And it was there we had negotiated that, you know, the union would support our focus on having more people of color who could be a psychologist and social workers. We would let them have the teachers. And we shook hands. That was a Friday or Saturday. By Monday, he was calling me, telling me, sorry, I can't do it. I was getting all these nasty, long letters from social workers and psychologists. It felt like a setup. And then he wanted to go through mediation. And I said, I'm not going through mediation. And I said, absolutely not. You made a deal. You shook our hand. And so I eventually relented and said, all right, we're going to cross every hurdle. We got into a meeting. He didn't like how it ended. Because they were telling us all these no's, we can't do this. It was us. It was John Matthews and his attorneys, Dan Nierad, the superintendent of schools, and his attorneys, and then me and my attorney and one of my staff members who ran the program, the charter school effort. And I told Laura, I said, Laura, who was leading the effort, not write down every time they tell us no. She's like, why is that? I said, I'll tell you later. So she was writing it down, and then she kept looking and rolling her eyes at me. Oh, we can't do that because of this. Oh, we can't do that because of that. And finally, when it got to me, I said, Laura, how many times did they tell us no? She said, 21 times, Kaleem. And I laid out for them. I said, okay, here's the deal. You guys say you can't modify this contract. You can't do what we need because of Act 10. I said, all right, but Act 10 goes into effect in a year. So we'll do a 5-year contract. Well, the first year, you guys get the teachers, and then year 4 and 5, because you don't exist yet anymore, we get to do what we want. And John Matthews went ballistic, because I was right. And he said, I see you got smart. You went to D.C. and you got smart, but he stood up and he pointed at me, banged his fist on the table several times and said, but young man, guess what? This is my game and you can't play it. Do you hear me? this is my game and you can't play it. And then he sat down and John Roach looked at him like, what just happened? He flipped. And so it was a power thing that we were dealing with, too. And at that point, we knew, you know what, this isn't going well.
Well, and I'm thinking as these battles between leaders are happening, mm-hmm. then you've got all the parents that you were talking about, Sue, who are reluctant to talk to anyone if they have to use their name. Mm-hmm. So you don't get the stories of the people whose children would be most affected mm-hmm. by whatever happens. I know there was a situation that I ran into having to do with the UW Odyssey project that I run where one of my students had talked about how he was thinking of coming back to Madison to take a job and decided that his children would feel safer in South Carolina than in Madison. And I said, well, Joe, you should write about that. Mm-hmm. You know, that needs to go in the paper. He was reluctant. He did. He had his name in. It was a guest, you know, opinion piece in the State Journal. He got over 100 vitriolic, dripping with racism comments. And think the, you know, that's another thing I was going to ask you about is that in addition to the sort of mainstream media coverage, there's this kind of awful, sometimes anonymous or through, you know, fake name thing that can be happening in the comments sections, in Facebook postings, in all sorts of things that can escalate and, mm-hmm. and make people feel awful.
We looked at four other cities besides Madison. We looked at Ann Arbor, Michigan, Evanston, Illinois, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and Cambridge, Massachusetts. And so we looked at all of the social media around race issues in those four places during a set time period. And the vitriol with the comments was just really depressing and startling, actually. And some towns were worse than others. But there's some research out that actually argues seeing that in the commenting sections is a positive thing for race relations in the sense that you uncover what had been sort of lay race, you know, hidden racism, and that once it's out there, you can work with that. You can see the kinds of arguments that they're making. A lot of it's just trolling, but some of it is an uncovering of what is actually happening in people's heads emotionally and identity-wise. So what we saw in Madison, particularly in the comments, were these two or three different Madison identities that people were clinging to, and these feelings of defensiveness and territorialness and this mm-hmm. understanding, particularly from white progressives, that they were their grip was slipping. You know, the demographics of the schools were now a so-called minority-majority in the schools, even though voter-wise we're still majority white. But that's going to change, right? And so what you see in the comments is kind of reflective of this internal battle that's happening.
We're going to look at some ideas for positive change going forward in terms of racial bias in the media and public talk when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. Self in training in cultural competency, diversity, privilege, and your own implicit biases. Learn the history of inequities in your community and organization. Be aware of the ways in which your routines inadvertently leave community members out. That's just three of the many tips for public communicators included in the book Network News, Racial Divides, How Power and Privilege Shape Public Discourse in Progressive Communities by one of my guests, Sue Robinson. Also with me is Kaleem Kerr, and we are talking about racial bias in the media and public talk. In the time that we have left, You know, mostly we've been talking about what happened in 2010 or 11 or 2013, looking back at a time of tremendous change and sort of disappointment, frustration. Can you take us sort of more into the future? What can be done differently? What is being done differently? And, you know, what sort of gives you hope? And I'm going to start with you, Colleen. Okay.
Yeah, you know, I think the few things that can be done differently and things that are happening now, you know, the media has tried to make a conscious effort to include the voices of people of color in telling their own stories. And, you know, I think all the media outlets in Madison have actually been trying that. I think the emergence of Madison 365 has also helped with that because they've provided a healthy dose of competition with the local media market in terms of why we listen and why we read that online newspaper. They do a great job of using our words to share what we think and how we feel and what we're doing. So I think that the media has been responsive in that regard. The big thing is the community. When I left the Urban League, I had to finally present a position where I could just kind of sit back and see what people were doing. I wasn't the main subject in the movement. And when I was watching how many people were trying to get involved or getting involved in this issue, even if they were taking steps, I was like, that's a little outdated, or, you know, but they were trying to understand it and they were moving away from the conversation to what can we do? And so I saw more people taking that journey to call racial identity development, right, where they go from totally unaware of what's going on to now having some idea of what's happening. But now where do I fit in it? And so I saw people taking that journey and trying to figure out what role can I play. I saw it in that context, too. I saw more African-Americans and Latinos stepping up and being more unafraid to say what was going on or say how they feel, because some people would just be quiet. I'm like, why are you quiet? You got to say something. And then the third thing that I've seen is, and this is something I think that needs some help, but it's our youth. You know, they're starting to speak up more.
And that's a national movement.
That's a national movement. But in Madison, I think, again, where they need some help is all the institutions in Madison, I think, are totally structured around the needs of adults. Not the needs of children. I think the school system is structured around the needs of adults. What do they need first? What do the kids get second and third? If teachers don't feel they don't have this, or administration needs something, the parents need something, it's, well, what about the children? And you know, this community, so many children here would love to participate in sports and other kinds of activities, but there's no money for them to do that. And if there are scholarships, people aren't really reaching out to try to get kids involved in activities like that. And so you see our children, they're showing their frustration. They're exercising their voice in some positive ways, but also in some negative ways. But I look at that as kids stealing cars and all that stuff and them telling you, F you, I don't care what you think. They're actually telling the adults, look, I'm going to say what I say and what I feel about you, but how do we channel that so they say it and do it in more productive ways? So I think that a lot has happened where more people are finding their voice in this.
So you're feeling a sense of hope.
I do. I do.
I think we see that on campus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Mm-hmm. In the last few years, the activism that's been happening on there, there's a new Black Student Union. They've resurrected the Black Voice, which is an online magazine for and by Black people. The whole diversity training for all freshmen coming in. Like, you're starting to see a real change on campus with really strong activism and community leaders of Black and Brown students. I think that I hadn't seen since I got here in 2007. And then more broadly, we have the Justified Anger movement that's just got this giant grant and is doing all of this incredible work around health disparities, but also in educating white people about the history of race in Madison. And that's being led by Reverend Dr. Alex G. And along with the Madison 365 and the competition that's been happening, I see real changes in the conversation just among reporters as well and in public facilitators. And even in the PTO, I'm a member of my PTO at the Midvale Lincoln Schools, and they've asked me to run some workshops. And we ran one, and it was called How to Talk to Your Kids About Race. It was a Tuesday night. It was in the fall. And we had 100 people show up. Mm-hmm. And people are really keen on having this conversation and not just talking about it in terms of how do we lift the black people, but really about how do we change ourselves and who are we in this community and what kind of identity do we really want?
Do you see this extending beyond Madison? I know you looked as part of the book at four other progressive cities and other states. And then, you know, within Wisconsin, we've got a lot of difference from Madison to Milwaukee to elsewhere in the state. Do you see this as a broader change beyond Madison?
Well, I certainly do. And Kaleem, mm-hmm. who has more footholds in mm-hmm. a lot of different kind of national civil rights movements, probably could talk a little bit about that. But mm-hmm. I will say that in our cities that we looked at, and particularly around achievement disparities, we're seeing a lot of different kinds of programs that are really raising the bar. And even though achievement disparities and opportunity debts, as Dr. Ladson Billings talks about them as, are always sort of this give and take of two steps forward, one step back kind of thing, the amount of momentum that you see around these issues is really heartening.
Yeah, and I'll say that the media, and like I think of Paul Fallon and him sitting down with Dr. Alex G and myself, Michael Johnson and others, and literally at the Capital Times and saying, you know, I want to change the way we promote this and I want to hire some people and I don't have a lot of money and budget, but he did. He hired somebody and he literally allowed us to now start writing with our voice. He actually asked me to be a columnist and I do, but very intermittently. So that we can get our voice out there. And that was unprecedented. The Cap Times didn't do that before. Leo Heinen, he's always written about these mm-hmm. issues, but he was going deep and making a more strong commentary about these things, too, in a way where he could be influential. So we saw that. But I'll say I've worked in different places around the country. And I do have a national network. I don't know anywhere else that has gone from totally oblivious. That's at least how they act. And treating us as outsiders to now trying to bring us on the inside and listening to our voices and then community people like pushing and pressing in a way that I've seen and change such a short period of time anywhere in the country. And so what I'm also trying to do now is trying to convince my own peers that you guys, we also now got to start helping people see where they're creating the change, because if we just keep beating them up, they're not going to see that their efforts are producing anything of value and they're going to get burned out and become apathetic. They're going to stop. There's some great stuff happening. Let's do that. I think Race to Equity has really started to help us mm-hmm. move in that direction, along with other things that are happening. But then beyond that, even I've made a change. I learned something. I said, okay, I'm pretty good at this community activism thing. We all have to learn every day. Mm-hmm. I went from coming to Madison with that chip on my shoulder and saying, I'm going to show you guys how to get this done. And I'm going to get the people together that really want to get it done too. You know what? I'm going to use my organizing skills and show you how you can build it. Mm. And so that's where One City, the whole focus of One City, this new charter school and this new preschool effort, is to show Madison that you guys, we got the skill, we got the talent, we got the people, and we got the resources to change the game here. But you guys are going to do it. You're going to bring your best to this. You're going to build that village. So now white people, whether you're Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal, I don't care. You're going to all have skin in the game because you're going to realize that once you step in these doors that you're making a difference for these children, and both you and them will never be able to say we couldn't do it together.
And it'll be a collaborative.
It'll be a collaborative effort, and the commitment to our children will be there. We're seeing it.
Which goes back to your point, Sue, that the conversation had been binary, that it had been mm-hmm. you're either for it or against it, not let's talk mm-hmm. about different ways, different nuances. If you had an elevator ride to pitch how you'd like to see things to be different, what would you say to someone who's riding the elevator with you?
Well, the number one thing I would say is that white people need to step aside at this point. We're at the point where we need to give up power, I think, and we need to do things completely differently. There's all these other platforms that we can utilize and use our networks mm-hmm. to have these conversations in different ways.
Well, thank you for having this conversation with me. It's gotten lots of thinking going on my part about how change is possible. My guests have been Sue Robinson and Kaleem Kerr. And this is Emily Auerbach. I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.